You know, for my own sanity, lately I've been trying to do, like, positive stuff on the show, literally, just for my own sanity. But sometimes there's just so much news that you have to cover. So this week, I guess we're going to start kind of dark and work our way towards fun stuff. Does that sound good to you guys?
Sounds okay.
The other way?
Nah, I don't know. I'd rather get the bad stuff out of the way first. And
okay.
Then, yeah. This is Ask an Atheist with me, Sam Olvey, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. And our first news story, well, it's not all bad. A Turkish appeals court has overturned the blasphemy conviction against a pianist and prominent atheist. Fazıl Say was convicted of insulting religious beliefs in 2013 over a series of Twitter posts. The Supreme Court of Appeal ruled that his comments should be regarded as freedom of thought and expression, and thus should not be punished. Say accused the current ruling party, the Islamic Conservative Justice and Development Party, of being behind his conviction.
Justice and development. I wonder what they're developing, and I wonder what kind of justice.
Yeah, justice and development. So they're into legal proceedings and buildings.
I don't know.
I'm assuming.
Apparently, they're not into tweets that hurt their feelings over religious issues.
I kind of want to know why it's necessary to mention that the guy is a pianist. Like, what did he commit blasphemy with his piano somehow? I
think this is what he's well known for.
Like
people known for their musical, careers are often people who are followed on Twitter, or people who are actors often have their Twitter feeds. It's a way for the public to feel a little bit connected with someone that in maybe previous generations would feel a little bit not out of touch, but hard to reach, hard to relate to. There's a lot of distance between people. So if you follow, Zooey Deschanel's Twitter feed, then you feel like, oh, Zooey's one of my buds. So, I don't know. That's what I see it as.
This is all very disturbing to me.
Zooey Deschanel is not one of my buds, nor do I follow her on Twitter. But that is neither here nor there, I guess. So
we can neither condone nor condemn Zooey Deschanel.
So is Turkey's trying to get into the EU, isn't it?
You know what? There's all kinds of things that are, I don't know the answer to that question, but there's all kinds of things that one would think you would have to abide by as a country to be, accepted into the European Union. And one of them might be freedom of speech and freedom of press and things like that. But surprisingly, as we've seen, we have all kinds of European nations that have these laws that you cannot insult religious sensibilities.
For example?
Let's see. Austria had a lecturer, a university lecturer, that looked at the Prophet Muhammad in today's times that would be accused of pedophilia for marrying a 13-year-old or 12-year-old. And she was actually threatened with jail time and a $2,000 fine. We have Poland that has this as a strict law. And I think Sweden has you can't insult religious sensibilities or the crown.
Or the crown.
Yeah, something like that. So, they're in the process, a lot of these countries, of eliminating these kinds of laws. I'm in favor of eliminating those kinds of laws.
Yeah, me too. I mean, of course.
I can't help wondering in a country like Sweden, whether or not those things would actually be enforced or whether it's just sort of like, don't do that again, please.
Is this like no dragging a fish through the town square on the third Tuesday of a month? Is it those kind of laws where they were passed, they had some meaning when they were passed, but don't anymore, maybe?
Right. Yeah, like if you're drinking on your front porch, it's technically drinking in public, but if a police officer walks by, they're going to be like, come on, take that inside.
Yeah, just something like that.
Well, the problem with those kinds of laws, though, is that, everyone says, go along, move along. But if you, garner the ire of someone in particular, then you legally can be charged with these things. So,
and there are people who will use rarely enforced laws in order to put political pressure on people. So having them on the books, especially speech laws like this, are definitely a bad idea, because if somebody says something unpopular, then suddenly there's a lot of laws that apply to them that haven't normally applied to anybody, and suddenly they're not, welcome in the country anymore or something like that.
My thoughts exactly.
That's why we don't allow immigrants to walk an ugly horse down the street on Sundays.
Yes.
Which state has that one on the books now, Dan?
I believe it is this state. I, if memory serves, it was the city of Seattle. You were not allowed to take an ugly horse down the street on a Sunday.
Only pretty horses.
Right. Only pretty horses and sidewalks.
Do they have like a department of horse aesthetics that judges whether or not a horse is pretty or not?
You know, I feel like we're sort of dehumanizing the horse now.
Isn't that the nature of being a horse, Dan?
Who gets to decide whether or not the horse is free?
Well, that's my question.
Society at large, you know, well, let's put the whole thing on Tumblr and just see what happens.
Oh, boy, that'll end well. I mean, so, you know, let's say somebody walks a horse down the street, and then do they have to hold a referendum? I mean, is it a democratically chosen standard of beauty for horses? Is that
well, Tim Iman would take care of that somehow in a referendum, because it's Washington State, so.
Right.
And who's Tim Iman?
Our referendum king, our king of referendums of local direct democracy at Washington State.
Referendi?
Referenda. Yeah, duh. That sounds right.
Referenda.
Referendopodes?
Referendopodies.
Yes. Oh, boy. So a story that we have been following has been in Saudi Arabia, and Saudi authorities have ordered the continued flogging of atheist blogger Raif Badawi, according to a statement by Badawi's wife, Ensaf Haidar. The statement states that an informed source said that the punishment will resume, but happen inside the prison Badawi is being held in. Haidar expressed confusion over why the punishment would continue, since Badawi's case is still being reviewed by the Saudi courts. The sentence of 1,000 lashes began early this year, but halted after one session of 50 lashes. Haidar, who is living in Canada with her kids, beseeched the new Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to grant Badawi a white passport, or a temporary passport, to allow him to be reunited with his family.
So initially, those 50 lashes that he, received reprieve from temporarily so that he could heal from all of those things, I believe were carried out in public, sort of as
right.
to make a figure of this person. So to say,
yeah, the floggings will continue until morality improves,
oh,
basically.
Man. Ugh. And so now we're not even privy to being able to watch that. And it seems just like an overture.
Well, I'm okay with not watching a guy get flogged to death. I just, you know, can I have that out there?
I'm okay, too. But I think that there's something even possibly more sinister about having it behind closed doors that allows people to sort of out of sight, out of mind with this case. And we got to remind ourselves that these are things that are going on in countries that we're ostensibly allied with.
Yeah, we being the United States in this case.
We being the United States.
I wonder, so there is something sinister with this, where, yeah, now it's now the beatings are going to happen in private where nobody can see them. But there might, sinister could go both ways a little bit here, where maybe they're saying they're going to continue the beatings indoors where nobody can see them as preparation for just getting him out of the country. Where, yeah, we're just going to do it in private, you know. Because our religion commands us to, but holy cats, if we keep doing this, he's going to die. So we're just going to say we're doing it and then get him out. Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be great.
One can hope.
Yeah.
Seems unlikely. But I'm a creature of hope, of really, really unlikely hope.
Rooting for the underdogs, everything.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not...
108 years.
This is... Saudi Arabia is not the case of Turkey that say, oh, you know what, we're reversing this conviction for religious... for damaging or hurting religious sensibilities. Here, this is, we are basically sentencing a man to prolonged death for blogging about atheism.
Exactly. And I hope... I mean, the white passport concept, I mean, that's great, but then there's that the little matter of getting him out of prison, which would be really concerning. How would that be accomplished? Would they let him leave? I don't know how that would work.
Well, and the fact that this may help one man, but those laws are still on the books in Saudi Arabia that allow for someone to go through this again.
Absolutely. Speaking of flogging, the Indonesian province of Aceh has recently passed a law which will make gay sex punishable by 100 lashes. Local authorities told a French newspaper that anal sex between men and the rubbing of body parts between women for stimulation was legally banned by a law that passed last year. Sex between homosexuals is not criminal under Indonesian federal law, but the Aceh province holds to a much stricter Sharia law. Provincial Sharia chief Abbas said that the purpose of the law was to safeguard human dignity and protect Muslims from committing immoral acts.
Immoral acts like beating people for being with the people they love?
Yep.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense then. So I guess they're going to hire non-Muslims to do the beating so that the Muslims that would otherwise have to commit an immoral act don't have to commit such an immoral act as beating someone for...
But that's the fun thing about religion, where acts of love are immoral, but acts of hate are completely moral. That's
We also have to remember that Aceh province is the one that was devastated by the Sumatran megaquake. Yeah. And that I would think that even in the period of years since the enormous earthquake that caused a tsunami, there might be more infrastructural building needs that are more pressing than regulating who someone has sexual relations or contact with. I mean, that would be my opinion. I'm not sure what would be going through the minds of folks that are adhering to a very strict Sharia law, but it might be, as we've seen in other places, related to, hey, perhaps these immoral acts or things that our book tells us are immoral are causing our devastation upon our province.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we've just made a link here. I mean, Pat Robertson says that gay sex causes earthquakes, so maybe they're trying to, they've suffered so much from the recent quakes that they're trying to ban the idea from occurring entirely so that they don't get another earthquake.
Either way, can we start building things?
There might be some logic there, and this is like that might be actually be what people are thinking. And this is when I get my most derisive of religion. When I try not to be, I try to be positive. I don't people when you disrespect their religion, you disrespect them. Yes, I know I'm a professional religion disrespecter or whatever, but this is where I get my worst. It's like literally you believe invisible things shake the, like invisible people who control your every waking move shake the planet when somebody loves somebody else that isn't on the list
the approved
of approved
list?
the approved rubbing conventions of God. It's like, really? This is your religion of peace? This is what I'm supposed to believe? This is what brings people to church? This is what you're looking for? It drives me nuts. I literally, the only thing I got left is sort of a vague dislike and a lot of derision for stuff like this. I mean, there's also the fear of people getting harmed and all that stuff too, but I'm talking specifically about the thinking that leads to stuff like this. Like, 15 years ago now, when, you know, the World Trade Center was hit by planes, and then Pat Robertson, like you said, was immediately on the air saying how it was all our fault because we don't march in the right line.
Mm.
And it just, really? Let's do some emails. How about that?
Okay.
Sounds good.
Jason from the internet writes, is there really such a thing as militant atheism? Dan, I don't think I've heard you take a crack at this one, so.
I guess so. I mean, I have seen lots of different definitions of militant atheists.
Yeah.
Ranging from, like, Pol Pot to Daniel Radcliffe, who, you know, says that he is an atheist in public.
Right.
And says that he is a militant atheist in public. Well, we don't have any record of Daniel Radcliffe, as far as I know, bearing arms against anyone. Other than fictional characters. So, is there such a thing as militant atheism? I guess it really depends on what the definition is, but I would probably say yes in both cases. The things that were done by famous atheist leaders who are generally working for communism or something like that instead of actual atheism, were they militant atheists? Well, they were militant and they were atheists, but they weren't trying to spread atheism. They were working on a political ideology.
Right.
And as far as just speaking out in public and saying, hey, I'm an atheist, some of the things that a religious majority are doing are unconstitutional or are human rights violations. Well, if that constitutes militant atheism, then yeah,
well, here,
I do that.
Here's the standard. People like to say, you know, the Soviets were militant atheists. Pol Pot was a militant atheist because they were atheists because Marxism suggests atheism.
Right.
However, is George W. Bush, the former president, when he went to war with Iraq, he is a Christian. He believes his Christianity is tied to his patriotism. Does that make him a militant Christian? Does that make him exactly equitable to a crusader? When General MacArthur was prosecuting World War II, he was a Christian. Does that make him a militant Christian? Why do these people get a pass, but these others don't? And I know the answer is it's because it's social privilege. But that's the thing, is if they were going out and hurting people in the for the cause of atheism rather than some economic thing or you know, mere territory or something like that, then I think you'd have a case.
Mm-hmm.
See, I say militant atheism doesn't really exist. Not that it can't exist. It just doesn't presently. And because I do think the day is coming when somebody's going to go weird.
Terminator robots.
Right, because human beings, we make mistakes, we do dumb things for just about anything. For literally anything. So if we can get militant about a belief, we can definitely get militant about the lack of one. It's not an inability. But the standard for militancy is a little bit different. On one side, you've got the Hutari teenage riot or whatever, you know, militant Christians where they have guns and they shoot people and they kill people. And then on the other, you got Daniel Radcliffe, who just says on TV that he's an atheist. They're equally considered militant. And I don't, there's a serious double standard there.
I think that's really apt Agreed. Framing. And I think that, you know, sometimes people would want to accept the mantle of that in the more literary and outspoken sense. So everyone that I've heard of socially or, you know, who lives in a modern time that says, I am a militant atheist, is all speaking in that kind of, you know, what I am just outspoken and perhaps strident, maybe anti-theist in my beliefs, but not, as you said, Sam, wanting to take up arms in the name of atheism and eliminate people who are not atheist. So I would agree that that's very aptly framed, and it should give everyone food for thought to look at. If you say that atheists are militant, what does it mean when you replace another group of people with a different religious belief or a different conception of cosmology on that?
Absolutely. So we have another email. This is James from the internet. And he writes, I understand atheists are opposed to religious symbols on government property, having crosses removed from water towers and nativities taken down from public spaces. I get that, but that's about tearing things down. What are atheists as a people, so to speak, building? Like for the homeless or the poor, or people in other countries who are less fortunate.
Well, Dan, you never do anything good for the world. You never build anything. I mean, that whole day yesterday in the rain, you spent planting trees?
I can't say that I belong to a particular atheist organization whose ultimate goal is to build things. But as a person who happens to be an atheist, I like to go out and do outreach events and educate people, spread the word on environmental issues and political issues, and yeah, just good old getting muddy and planting trees for the sake of future generations and ecological restoration.
I have a very simple answer for this one.
You do work for a particular organization that does the building.
James, check out a little website called foundationbeyondbelief.org. It is a charitable organization. It's a charitable humanist organization, and it does everything you have said in this email. This organization does. That's why I wanted to work for them to begin with. So, it goes back to one of the reasons why we do this show, which was years and years ago, the Haiti earthquake. Somebody wrote a editorial in the News Tribune, which is the local paper, which at the time was kind of junk, but they've improved a little bit since. With some concerned citizen saying, well, you know, where are the atheists now that there's an earthquake and there's people who actually need help? You know, Christians are sending Bibles. And I'm like, and at the time, I was in the middle of helping Seattle atheists organize Red Cross drives, you know, all sorts of stuff for this. And I wanted a response to say, hey, okay, you want to know what we're doing? Here you are. Two sentences and I could solve it. They weren't interested. They weren't interested in
reprinting any kind of letters back.
No response allowed because the, you know, editorial page, editorial position.
I think they might have relegated us to the comment section of a newspaper, which we all know is a rich bastion of intelligent discussion.
Yeah. Now, like I said, that was years ago. The paper's a different thing now, and they've been very positive to the local atheism community since. So I don't want to paint them in a completely terrible light, but at the time, yeah, it was pretty bad.
I remember our conversation about that afterwards when it was like, well, they're working with everybody else, just not that many of them are particularly organized as specifically atheist organizations. And we talked and talked and said, you know, for those of us who aren't aligned with some particular organization, we should get t-shirts. Because, you know, all the religious groups are wearing their like purple t-shirt with the Jesus fish on the front saying, this is the group that I belong to. Well, you know, maybe the unaffiliated atheists should all get like t-shirts that have like a, you know, an open box of food on them or something, like atheist giving people help, so that people don't just assume that you're, well, they must be helping because they're a good and moral Christian. It's like, no, they're helping because they're a good and moral human. It really has nothing to do with the rest of it.
So it is kind of cool. I've gotten a little preview. You know, we've had Becca Witzman on the past, in the past on the show talking about humanist disaster recovery associated with Foundation Beyond Belief. And they've got some prototypes of the vests. So the very thing that you're talking about in terms of how to identify someone just happening to be a humanist or motivated by their humanistic beliefs to organize and help. And so that's coming. That's on the horizon.
Yeah.
But really wanting to be quite dedicated to doing it right and doing it well.
And there's a lot of people doing charitable work who are atheists who don't specifically want to be identified as an atheist because they don't want to do, they're not doing it for the marketing, which is what a lot of these organizations, these Christians, we're sending Bibles. Can't eat a Bible. Can't sleep in a Bible. On a Bible, perhaps. Well, okay, you can't really get a whole lot of vitamins out of a Bible. I'll put it that way.
I can think of, you know, after particular kinds of disasters, there might be a certain human resource that becomes scarce, that one they never talk about in post-apocalyptic movies and things like that, that distributing Bibles might actually be pretty good for.
Oh, I think, so you might
nice
use
little thin absorbent.
You pages. Might use them triple ply, perhaps?
Yes, perhaps.
Okay, I think I see where you're going with this. And I think we should stop now. but yeah, that's another thing that part of the reason why you don't see atheists like out there shouting about how they're atheists doing charitable work is because to them, it's not about atheism. It's about the work.
But to those who, for whom it is maybe a plus to be associated and gathered with atheists to be doing good works, a thing that has come up in recent years is many conferences, either local or national, will have some kind of charitable component to them.
Yeah.
So it's really neat when you see a national organization having a list of speakers, workshops, leadership development, and then, oh, all day, you know, Saturday afternoon between noon and six is the blood drive. So in between going to your workshops, come by and donate blood.
Hey, I have an idea. Let's try and build a shelter out of a Bible.
Okay.
Yeah, let's see if it's like possible if you could build some sort of tent that lasts for like a couple days. And said, so finally, we're saying, yes, you're doing something worthwhile by sending Bibles. You can turn them into tents.
This almost seems like, oh, no, Mythbusters is canceled. Dang it. no, I feel like if we could get like, you know, the right kind of glue, just something simple and flower-based, you could easily make like
a paper mache tent?
Yeah, like a lamellar type roof that would, you know, shed mild rain for while.
I think this might be a future episode. So I've got some people to thank. I'd like to thank Rich from Actual Kent and Mike from Radio versus the Martians for meeting Peggy's Challenge. Peggy's Challenge is the challenge from Peggy from local Kent to the listeners of Ask an Atheist to help us keep the lights on. Every dollar you give us goes directly towards show production. You can go to our website, askanatheist.tv, click on the yellow button on the right-hand side, take you right to our PayPal page. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We're going to go to break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about that whole praying in Bremerton and some of the folks who showed up and how, and it's a great interview. You're going to love it.
The Humanists of Washington is the oldest humanist organization in the state and offers a community of freethinkers who educate the public and celebrate life. Come celebrate life with us. Humanists support intellectual freedom and critical thinking and hold that human beings are autonomous centers of moral development. You can become a member of the Humanists of Washington at humanistsofwashington.org. You'll get our quarterly publication, The Secular Humanist Press. Check out meetup.com where you can be part of our monthly Seattle dinner and our Heathens Do It Better breakfast. Humanists of Washington.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Dorn, and we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio versus the Martians. Every month, we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio vs. the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVsTheMartians.com.
Ask an Atheist may have gone on the road, but we're not making big bucks.
We still need to keep the lights on, and 95% of our costs are for airtime alone.
That's why we need your contributions.
If you've got something to advertise, consider Ask an Atheist in your ad budget.
Our listener Peggy said it best. Step up and contribute to keep secular voices on the air. For $5, you could have a latte or a moment of science.
Take on Peggy's challenge and contribute today.
For details, go to askanatheist.tv or contribute directly via PayPal to paypal@askanatheist.tv.
At Puget Sound Celebrant Service, we want to be your secular wedding officiant. We are committed to serving the Puget Sound region and work to ensure your special day is all about you. Robert, a certified humanist celebrant with the Humanist Society, specializes in secular weddings and customizes ceremonies to fit your needs. To commemorate your special day, each couple married by Robert will receive a one-year membership to the American Humanist Association. Find out more at PugetSoundCelebrant.com.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. Joining us now is Lilith Starge, the founder and leader of the Seattle chapter of the Satanic Temple and the author of the book, The Happy Satanist, Finding Self-Empowerment. She led members of her chapter to Bremerton High School's football game last week in support of students and staff who opposed Coach Joe Kennedy praying with players after the game. How you doing today, Lilith?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Doing pretty good.
So, Lilith, can you tell us about this trip to Bremerton, how it went? You know, you get off the ferry, and what happens?
So, well, first off, we decided to drive around. The traffic was good. So we drove into Bremerton. The game was going very quickly, so we had thought that we would get there like half hour before the end, but it looked like it was going to end pretty quickly, so there was kind of a rush to get it done. So as we drove past the Bremerton Stadium, you know, we passed the first news truck with its power up, and then we passed another one and another one, and they were lined up down the block as we were driving in.
Wow. So,
you know, and here we are in this little tiny town. We get out of our cars and we put on our robes, these kind of shiftward looking robes with hoods that cover our faces, except for myself and a couple other people. And we have a woman dressed as Lucifer with great big horns. And a lot of makeup. So here we are kind of gathering in this neighborhood. We're definitely starting to attract a little bit of attention. But luckily we had a contact who lived in Bremerton, and he had been kind of scoping things out for us. And, you know, he knew where to go. He led us up. And we came up to the entrance of the stadium. On our way there, we had to kind of pass most of the stadium, and inside, I could hear people, like, they saw us coming, and they said, "Oh my God, it's the Satanists! They're real!
they're real?"
Yeah, they're real! And they started running, and like, this crowd kind of started collecting as we were walking up the street next to the stadium, you know. So by the time we were reaching the gate, there was a lot of people up there. They were keeping the crowd inside the stadium, I think for our protection. There was a lot of screaming. They were throwing holy water on us.
Wait, really? This sort of like real water from carafes that have been blessed and wrapped in rosaries?
I have no idea. They were sort of like rabid animals behind behind a cage, screaming and throwing stuff. And so we came up. We didn't want to go in. We didn't really want to take away from the game. There was a game going on. We just wanted to show up and meet the students that had invited us.
Right.
So we got to meet them. They came out, and we got to hug them and say hi. I invited them to our Satanic Thanksgiving that's coming up in a few weeks. And we smiled and waved, and then we left. It was kind of a quick strike, and we got to say hi. And it was just really cool to see the students that had the bravery to invite us, because, you know, no one was really willing to stand up in that town to that coach or the sort of very vocal Christian element in that small town. So it was really cool to see them.
Was it primarily the students that made you want to get involved with this situation, or were there some other factors?
It was. Also, we heard from teachers, we heard from community members. You know, we were concerned mostly about the constitutional rights of the teachers and the students at the school, you know, to be free from having religion kind of forced upon them. So that's who we were looking out for foremost.
So right before the game, Coach Joe Kennedy was actually put on leave from his position, or, you know, about a day prior. And so he wasn't, there wasn't sort of this threat of him in his coaching position leading prayer at the 50-yard line as the, as it has been in the past. What made you want to come out in spite of his dismissal from being able to coach at this point?
We wanted to come out just to meet the students who had invited us. We withdrew our request to do an invocation. We think the school district may have put him on leave after we sent them a letter basically asking for permission to do our invocation or, you know, do the right thing and do whatever necessary to stop Coach Kennedy. And they did. They stopped him. So we withdrew our request, and part of the reason we were there was to support the school for doing that.
So what would have a satanic invocation looked like at that point? I mean, would you have been on the 50-yard line? Are there, you know, bent knees? What goes on?
Well, we wouldn't do it. We would try to not do it right next to Coach Kennedy. Like, our goal was not to, you know, get into a confrontation with him. So we had, we had 10 people coming out onto the field in the V formation. We're all in our dark robes, except for the woman dressed as Lucifer in the front. And we come out with incense and a gong, and we pause and we turn to the audience and we perform, we read an invocation, and then the Lucifer character bites an apple and she gives it to me to bite, and then we go off the field. And that's it. It's very simple. The invocation is secular. It's very similar to the one that Lucian's used at other occasions. So that would be it. But
And this is Lucian Greaves. I think we've had him on the show before. He isn't local to Seattle, but you guys are pretty new in terms of the Satanic Temple in this area. Is that correct?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. We've only been around for a year. I applied to the chapter head like last October, and then we really had our first meeting in December. So it's just been about a year now.
Almost. So once again, I know I have the sense about the kind of emails I'm going to get usually with episodes. And one we have to visit on this one is sort of the positioning of the Satanic Temple and what you guys are about. It's you'd sort of take on the mantle of the literary Satan, not you guys aren't. You guys are atheists, as far as I know, correct?
Yeah, actually, we're non-theists. We're a non-theistic religion. We don't believe in any supernatural forces. We believe beliefs should conform to our best scientific understanding of the world. We draw our inspiration from the literary Satan of William Blake and other romantic writers. Like, right after the Enlightenment, they were writing out against, you know, the tyranny of the church and the church-sponsored government, and they're speaking up for the rights of the human against that kind of tyranny and tyranny of authority. And so that's where we take our inspiration for our literary figure of Satan.
And what I find really interesting and wonderful here is that you guys only showed up because you were at Bremerton because you were specifically invited. I think that's a very important point to make in this situation, because a lot of people who want to get weird about religion in public places, it's sort of an enforced thing where I'm going to do this as part of my attempt to convert the entire planet, where you guys showed up because somebody asked for you, somebody who went to that school.
Absolutely. I mean, there would be no other reason for us to do that. It was a number of students who felt really uncomfortable with what was going on. They were atheists. They didn't feel like their beliefs were being represented, you know, and they had the courage to reach out to us. And actually, the senior class president, Abe Bartlett, actually talked to the press. Like, he actually came out, you know, at anonymity, and he spoke in support of us. So we were pleased to get that student support. That's really why we showed up. We wanted to show our support for them, because that was a really brave move, I thought, in that town. Like, we just came in and we did our thing and we left, but they're there and they have to deal with the consequences. So, you know, they're inspiring to me.
It sounds like you had a lot of support coming from some students, but in general, the crowd was sort of against you at the school. What exactly, what does it feel like to be in that environment? Did you ever feel that you were in any danger, or were there threats being issued?
Oh, yes, there were definitely threats being issued. And as we were leaving, there were a few people that said, you know, we should just shoot them, or somebody shoot them. And I didn't hear that at the time. They were kind of just screaming and chanting Jesus. They were throwing, as I said, holy water on us. But what really broke my heart was when the student who had invited us, when they came up through that crowd, they were calling her names, calling her dyke, telling her, everybody hates you. You know, and as that student came up, I just felt so bad that they had to go through that. But I didn't feel like there was any danger. We left, you know, after a fairly brief time. I didn't really want to take away from the game, like with those people shouting and just kind of going nuts like a Beatles concert back there. I thought it was probably, seriously, it was strange. You know, I didn't want that to become a distraction from their last home game. I really didn't. So we took off, you know, after about 15 or 20 minutes.
Might be the only group involved who didn't want to cause a distraction, incidentally, if you've been following the press on this one. But you did get a lot of media attention because of this, even though, you know, trying to be respectful. Sometimes the press isn't so much, speaking as the press sometimes. Is this the first time the Seattle chapter has been getting a lot of public attention?
We got a little bit of attention last year at the beginning. We're starting a campaign down in Clark County, like where Vancouver is. they put up an In God We Trust plaque, so we have a proposal for an E Pluribus Unum plaque that we want to float. So we're going to go down there in January and do that. But we got some attention then, but this just, you know, is magnitudes of order more. It really kind of blew us away how much the story got picked up. It was kind of crazy.
It was actually, I was in on a bit of the Clark County stuff, and at some point I asked somebody who lived down there, have you guys called the Satanic Temple people yet? And they're like, no. And then 10 minutes later, we started hearing about this. I'm like, perfect, yes! We're working together. Yeah, the Clark County thing was hilarious. Especially...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead. Oh, I was going to say, we're working with Robert Ray, too. He's going to help us get down there. And
oh, very good. Yeah, Robert is, in fact, one of the person I was talking to at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I heard you guys went down there. So
yeah, it was...
Let's do it again.
I want to ask about the proposal or the choice to make the Lucifer figure a woman, because that seems a little bit out of alignment with some of that literature and some of that symbolic things. Is that a sort of modern twist on sort of pulling the strings, turning things upside down?
Well, first off, the symbol for the Satanic Temple, Baphomet, who is not Lucifer, is a hermaphrodite and is both. For Lucifer, I mean... Lucifer was an angel, and as you know, it's angels seem kind of sexless. I don't think there's any really, you know, they're one way or another. So I don't know. I don't think it was necessarily, you know, historically inaccurate, I would say.
Well, in either case, I love it. I just love the sort of drama of having this sort of these symbols out there. How difficult is it to convince people that you're not actually worshiping a literal Satan?
You know, it's kind of surprisingly easy. It's pretty clear what we're about, especially in this case, you know, and a lot of people don't even realize we're a serious religion. They think we're atheists dressing up in Satanist costumes, you know, and that's fine. Like, I think that people now, if they're reasonable people, they get what we're doing. Obviously, if it's someone who has that sort of primal fear of Satan, like from an evangelical background, no matter what we say or how reasonable or compassionate we are, that's not going to reach them. They're just going to see Satan, you know, and see a real force of evil, which, yeah, it's kind of crazy.
So this is an interesting concept, because, like, if I were to do stuff like this, I would literally be just an atheist dressing up, because I'm not a part of any particular organized religion. But you guys do consider yourself a non-theistic religion. And what makes the Satanic Temple, in this case, a non-theistic religion rather than just some other form of social group?
Well, I think we're a lot like a religion in that we have a very deep purpose that unites us. Like, we have a meaning to our lives, and it's provided by our religion. We also have room for ceremonies in our religion, weddings. I wouldn't call them christenings, but maybe satanings. you know, and we want to meet, and we want to provide that for that need that people have for the sacred without any reversion to the supernatural. So, you know, I think as opposed to just a strictly atheist group, you know, we have a lot of symbols that we like to display or meditate on. You know, we have that mindset, but we really think that supernaturalism doesn't need to be a part of that.
And so what brought you personally to this?
Well, I had been a Satanist for only 4 years before I joined the temple. I would say I was sort of a Zen atheist scientist witch before. kind of hard to describe. But when I met my husband and I fell in love with him, I read his copy of the Satanic Bible by Anton LaVey. And what I took from that was self-compassion and self-empowerment. I had been addicted to nitrous oxide for 15 years, like ever since grad school. And I had been trying for 9 years in Narcotics Anonymous to get off. Mm-hmm. And I really, really, really wanted to stop. But I couldn't. And, you know, in all the 12-step programs, their deal is that you have to realize that only God can fix you, that you're completely powerless over your addiction, and you have to pray constantly for your higher power, whatever that is, to fix your defect. I'm an atheist, so, and as a magician, like, I hold my true will as kind of my highest power, and they said, you know, your higher power can be anything except yourself. It has to be something outside yourself. You know, preferably something supernatural, but it could even be a doorknob. It just can't be yourself. And so I really struggled with that. And, you know, when I read this kind of self-empowering book, like, hey, nothing except yourself is going to take charge of your life and do it, that really awakened in me the willpower to do that. Oh, well, if no one else can stop my addiction, then it's up to me to build a life that doesn't have any room for that. So I did, and I've been 2 years clean. And,
congratulations.
Thank you. And I saw the Satanic Temple come on the news with their Baphomet statue, which was just delightful.
Yes.
and then I saw them use the Hobby Lobby ruling to fight for women's reproductive rights. And that's when I contacted them and I said, hey, how can I help? How can I get involved? You guys are doing a really great job, and I'm proud to be a Satanist because of you guys.
So this sounds like it leads a bit into your book, The Happy Satanist, Finding Self-Empowerment. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
Sure. So that's a book of personal essays I wrote during my recovery. I wrote them at the time for the Satanism Facebook page, which was kind of run like a magazine. And it was really exciting to me to be able to write for an audience of Satanists. Satanists are definitely have been very individual creatures, and we certainly haven't come out of the woodwork much. You know, it's not a very popular move to come out as a Satanist. So it was really exciting to actually have contact with other Satanists and to see that community grow. So my book is my gift to that community. That community healed me, and it is still healing me. So that's kind of why I wrote it and why I put it out there.
So on an online community, that could reach people in any locale, but the Seattle Temple is very new, like you said, about a year old. What kind of plans does the Satanic Temple of Seattle have coming up?
Well, basically, we stand on guard to protect constitutional rights wherever an issue crops up. So we're always on the lookout for, you know, anything in the state of Washington where we might be able to help. So we have that Clark County case coming up. We'll probably go down to the Westlake area during the Christmas shopping season and stand next to the Jehovah's Witnesses for our literature as well. We did that a couple of weeks ago. It was a big hit.
I can imagine.
We got a lot of double takes. People would walk by and, you know, they'd ignore us, and then they'd see the big, you know, pentagram with a goat's head, and they'd be like, whoa, what? Yeah, so, you know, we try to have fun with it. You know, we're a serious religion, but, you know, we're lighthearted people, and, you know, we like to have fun with it.
So if a listener wanted to join you in the fun and find out more about Seattle's Satanic Temple or a chapter near them, where do they go?
So actually we have a public info meeting coming up December 6th. That's a Sunday. It'll be at the Fremont Library in Seattle at 3 p.m. And so everyone is welcome. All ages are welcome. We'll be downstairs in the basement.
Fantastic. Lilith Starr is the founder and leader of the Seattle chapter of the Satanic Temple and the author of the book, The Happy Satanist, Finding Self-Empowerment. She led members of her chapter to Bremerton High School last week regarding the whole Joe Kennedy praying thing. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on. It was an honor.
We'll probably have you on again sometime soon.
Okay, you guys take care.
This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We're going to go into a break. When we come back... for science.
If you are a humanist, atheist, or freethinker from Everett, Washington to the Canadian border, Humanists of North Puget Sound welcomes you. Your freethought neighbors to the north have been promoting secular ideas for over 20 years. They're humanists with a rational worldview, informed by science, inspired by art, and motivated by compassion. Join up for monthly conversation, camaraderie, and activism. Humanists of North Puget Sound. Visit humanistsnps.org.
If you enjoy the programming we create on Ask an Atheist, please make a contribution with us. Your sponsorship keeps our show in the air and improves the quality of our broadcasts. Don't make us beg. Please go to askanatheist.tv and contribute today.
Billy! I am the Queen of England. You must give me your lunch money.
Why?
Because it'll explode.
I don't know.
I'm the Queen of England. I know things.
Well, that makes sense. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because an authority says it doesn't make it true. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I'm melting!
48 hours. 24 hours. 10 minutes to go.
The motorcade appears to have stopped, and yes, it appears as though the governor is getting out now. It's hard to see. My God, the rain is it's coming down in sheets. I've never seen anything like this. There must be tens of thousands of people out here right now. The streets are shut down. Okay, it appears the governor is making his way toward the convention center. No one knows what he's going to say. The crowd is pushing forward through the storm. The Secret Service is struggling to hold them back. A wave of people are rushing toward the candidate. My God.
Zero. For your consideration, we present Convention and its subject, the nominee. ANNEXRadio.com. Now on iTunes and Stitcher.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. And we have an email. This is Eric from Kentucky who asks, I'm just curious. I heard that evolutionists believe that the whale descended from a land mammal. What evidence in the bone structure of the whale are they basing this on? Well, you want an answer to this question? Boy, howdy, do we have one. Here's Dan Lombardo with For Science.
Thanks, Eric. That is a great question, and I'm glad you asked. The evolution of whales from small land mammals to the sea-dwelling giants that we know today is one of the best-supported cases in the entire fossil record. We have great fossils of almost every step along the way, and modern cetaceans, that is, whales, dolphins, and porpoises, have retained a lot of that history, not just in their skeletons, but in the way their embryos develop. So let's start with the basics. Whales are air-breathing mammals that feed their young milk from mammary glands, just like land mammals. Whales have four-chambered hearts, like other mammals. They also have warm blood and a number of other mammalian features. But everyone knows that mammals have hair, right? So how can a whale be a mammal if it has no hair? Well, it turns out they do, actually. Baleen whales, or mysticetes, which literally means mustache whales, often have hair follicles on their heads that appear as bumps in the skin called tubercles. But each bump really does contain a hair. Scientists believe that these tubercles may perform a sensory function as they are located in the same places on whales that terrestrial mammals have their whiskers, around the upper and lower jawline, the chin, and the top of the head. These tubercles are packed with nerves, so it's possible that, like whiskers, they may help baleen whales to find their prey. Toothed whales, like dolphins and porpoises, do not have prominent tubercles as adults, but instead have patches of hair on the sides of their heads as embryos in the womb. These patches are usually lost before or shortly after death, after birth. However, there is one species of toothed whale that retains its whiskers for its whole life, the boto, or Amazon river dolphin. It lives in murky freshwater, so it's likely that these hairs help it locate its prey in the dark, just like the whiskers of a cat. Oh, but you asked about bones, didn't you? Well, another mammalian trait concerns the bones of the inner ear. Mammals have three of them that allow them, and us, to hear higher frequencies that other animals can't detect. In modern whales, these bones are set up in a very interesting way so that sounds reaching the sides of the animal's head get deflected down the lower jaw. This trait was shared by a group of predatory land mammals called pachycetids that lived about 50 million years ago, but is now only found in cetaceans. Similar ear structures were possessed by my personal favorite ancestor of modern whales, which lived about 49 million years ago. Ambulocetus has got to be one of the craziest looking mammals ever to have lived. Imagine a river otter. Now take that long body and dense hair and stretch it out until it fits the silhouette of a crocodile. That's Ambulocetus. In addition to that unique configuration of the inner ear bones, this guy also had a large mandibular foramen, which is a fancy way of saying that its bones indicate that it had a fatty pad running down the lower jaw to help conduct sound to the inner ear, just like those of modern whales. Remingtonocetids are another ancestor of modern whales that existed 49 to 43 million years ago. While the pachycetids lived on land, and Ambulocetus was probably a semi-aquatic ambush predator, Remingtonocetids were probably the first in the cetacean lineage to really commit to the life aquatic. Evidence supporting this includes nasal openings at the end of the snout, much more convenient for surfacing to breathe, and reduced semicircular canals. On land, semicircular canals are used for balance. However, once an animal becomes aquatic, that becomes less important. These guys also had very short limbs, adapted well for swimming, but not so great for moving on land. From about 49 to 41 million years ago, we find the fossils of a group called the rhodocetids. At this point in the lineage, we first see evidence of the fused vertebrae of the sacrum, the bones that attach to the pelvis, becoming unfused as they are in currently living cetaceans. This allows more flexibility, which is necessary for spinal oscillation, the much more efficient way of moving through water used by modern whales. 41 to 35 million years ago lived the basilosaurids and duradontids, the first really recognizable whales. Their fossil skeletons show us that they were fully aquatic, with no part of their lives taking place on land. Their nostrils were about halfway up the snout on the top surface, not quite, but almost the blowholes that we see in modern whales. Their mandibular foramens ran the entire length of their lower jaws, and just like modern cetaceans, their inner ear bones were insulated from their skulls by air-filled sinuses. And while they had four tiny limbs, their pelvic bones were no longer attached to their spines, just like modern whales. From there, we go through a number of species that slowly diverged into the odontocetes, modern toothed whales like dolphins and sperm whales and orcas, and the mysticetes, or baleen whales. The phylogeny isn't entirely sorted out due to the staggering number of fossil specimens. There's still some conjecture and debate as to which modern groups are most closely related and by which common ancestor, but that's part of the fun of science, putting the puzzle back together. Now, one more thing to talk about here is the bone structure of a modern whale's flippers. They contain five digits, with carpals, metacarpals, a radius, ulna, and a humerus, just like our arm bones. So if you decide to high-five a whale, you can rest assured you are indeed getting a high-five, and not just a high one. Depending on the species, modern whales not only have pelvic bones, but some also have femurs, and even tibias, despite a lack of external hind limbs. If there was any remaining doubt, sometimes a whale is born with an unusual mutation. The genes that code for long hind limbs, and normally remain dormant, become active, leading to whales with hind legs. This atavism is well documented in several species, but the most recent example comes from a bottlenose dolphin caught on October 28th of 2006 with fully formed hind limbs, an extra set of flippers. This dolphin was named Haruka and was moved to the Taiji Whaling Museum in Japan, where she was kept alive and studied until her death in April of 2013. So that was a pretty long answer, but thanks for asking, Eric. I hope I covered everything, and if you have any further questions, please let me know.
If you have a question for Dan for his For Science segment, you can go to Ask an Atheist, click on the red candy-like button on the left-hand side, and let us know. Be fantastic. Unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for today. My name is Sam. With me was Dan Lombardo and Rebecca Friedman. I'd like to thank Lilith Star and Dave Brulette. You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv. You can email us at questions@askanatheist.tv. You can Twitter us at askanatheistwa. I'm sure there are other ways that are escaping me. See you guys next week.